The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. My name is Flavia Jimenez, and I am an attorney by training. Right now I'm working on policy at National Council La Raza. National Council of La Raza is the largest Latino-based constituency organization that works toward the civil rights of Latinos in the United States. And we have over 300 affiliates all over the country, including places like Alaska and Hawaii, believe it or not, that all work on one level or another for servicing the Latino community. So we have everything from education to health programs to organizations working on advocacy in the Latino community, and many organizations also take a piece of their time, if possible, and work on federal legislation. And our policy office in D.C. Works on things such as education, health, everything related to workforce development. So anytime a bill comes out of Congress that deals with Latinos or the impact on Latinos, we're there. And we're checking it out, making sure that the possible effects and consequences of the legislation are not detrimental to our community. We also have a civil rights person. And who works on criminal justice issues, juvenile justice issues. I myself work on comprehensive immigration reform. And in my previous life at CASA of Maryland, which is an NCLR affiliate, I worked on employment law. So that's why I'm here. And I'm very happy to share this information with you because I think it's one of those most fascinating things happening in our country right now. And that's not an exaggeration. The issue of immigrants working in this country is probably one of the hottest topics in the United States. Why is that? Well, I think it's twofold, and I think that I'll try and describe to you the importance of this issue generally, and it's going to take two prongs. The first prong is, of course, our immigration laws. And where these things meet, you'll see soon, right? So first of all, we have this immigration system, and I'm just going to throw it out there. I just want to know to what extent you all know about immigration law. And who knows when the last time is that the United States had a legalization program in place for those people who are living in the United States undocumented? What year? Okay, it was 1986. The last time that there was any program passed by Congress that gave documented status to people who, on a broad basis, gave documented status to those living in the United States without documents was 1986. So, wow, right? Like, I was thinking I was still watching cartoons. Like, that was a long, long time ago. So what has happened since 1986 in the immigration law? Well, a lot of bills have passed since 1986 relating to immigration, but nothing that has been a comprehensive, and I hate to use the word amnesty because we don't like that word, it's a bad word, but a legalization program to give people some sort of status in the U.S. So our system, our immigration system is generally broken, and how are we going to fix this problem, I think, is the topic of conversation among many, many people in the United States. I was just having a conversation with one of my fellow panelists about this, and what's happened in the United States is that the issue of immigration has become very polarized. You have people who are right now standing on our borders with Mexico with guns, waiting for people to come in, as I'm sure that you've heard about the Minutemen. You've got these Minutemen and the organizations that are tied to the Minutemen Project proposing state ballot initiatives in Arizona, like Proposition 200, which you may or may not have heard of, which seeks to limit the benefits that an undocumented immigrant can access in the United States. But it goes far beyond that. It also seeks to limit a person's ability to vote in Arizona because it asks for proof of citizenship when that person votes. And so you have things that try, state ballot initiatives and state legislation being introduced that seeks to limit the benefits or the access to benefits of undocumented immigrants in their state. And why is this happening? It's happening because people on the ground are very frustrated because of our broken immigration system and the fact that unskilled or low-skilled workers in the United States have no legal way of entering the U.S. How many visas are available to low-skilled or unskilled workers that are trying to enter the United States to do jobs such as landscaping or dishwashing in a restaurant? 10,000. We have a flow of 500,000 people entering the United States every year, approximately, a third of whom are caught on the border, and 90% of whom are subsequently released by the Border Patrol because there are simply not enough beds to keep them and hold them in detention. And so what do we have is that we have a system in which we've increased the Border Patrol, we've increased the technology along the border, and we have not allotted enough visas for people to enter the country to come here and work, which is exactly, of course, why they're coming here. Immigrants are coming into the United States, and they're having to duck the Border Patrol and walk through the desert. And we have the highest rate of death along the border of any year in our history in the United States. And that is because people are going to come into the United States and are going to come to work. So that leads me to the employment piece of this, which is, of course, how is it then that the United States government is going to implement policies and implement rules and laws that are going to keep people from coming into the United States. If they're not going to keep people from coming into the United States, how will they make it possible for a person to come in legally and work legally and leave if they wish after a certain number of years? Well, what has been tried in the past is a so-called employment verification, right? So anytime you've gone to get a job, I'm sure you've been asked for certain documentation like, you know, your ID and your Social Security card. And the whole I-9 process was developed out of this sort of need to keep people in place. So you say, okay, I'm an employer, but I need to know that you're here illegally. Well, if any of you guys have walked down Columbia Road in Adams Morgan, there are probably about, you know, 15 different places where you can go and get yourself a really nice Social Security card for about $100, okay? And you know what? As far as the employer is concerned, that's all they need, because that's all that's required by law for them to do is simply check an ID to say that you are who you are and then also check a Social Security card or a green card, et cetera. So there's this list of documents. Well, I'm focusing on employer verification because employment seems to be the reason why people are coming into the United States. Employers are very, very interested in hiring these workers. We have no problem in hiring workers. I'm sure often you've seen construction workers, you know, or landscape people, or even the people that work here in your law school, perhaps. I don't know. They might be a little bit more careful about checking documents here, but oftentimes, and we run into being serviced by people who are in the United States undocumented every single day of our lives. And even folks who think that they are not coming into contact with people who are undocumented, the food on their plate probably comes from people who picked strawberries and grapes who are undocumented, right? So it's this chain is very long, right? And we have approximately 11 million people who are here undocumented. So back to employer sanctions. Employer sanctions have not worked, and that was in the 1996 Immigration Law Reform Act. And this situation has led to companies and employers hiring consistently people who are undocumented and simply asking them for these documents and them going along and hiring them, the process by which these people pay into our tax base and our Social Security system is extraordinary. $400 billion approximately in Social Security Administration money in this expense account fund that in Social Security is income that comes into Social Security by people paying taxes whose Social Security numbers cannot be matched with a real Social Security number. Right, so when you match these two names and these two Social Security numbers, there's no match. Well, there's $400 billion that's paid into that. So immigrant workers making a significant contribution to the United States economy, not just by servicing and accessing and purchasing American products, but also paying into our tax system and our Social Security system. And as a result of all of this sort of lack of total disappearance of the rule of law when it comes to hiring undocumented workers, the worker is then in a position in which the contract with that employer is oftentimes based on exploitation. Because if an employer is an unscrupulous person, the employer has every single ability to say, look, Juana, don't even think about joining your other workers and having a meeting with me and asking me for higher wages. I know that I'm only paying you $5.15 an hour, and I know that you're not able to survive on my $5.15 an hour. Because who can survive on $5.15 an hour, right? We're in D.C. especially. But don't even think about organizing with your fellow workers, because you know what? I know that you're undocumented, and I'm just going to call immigration enforcement on you. Total chilling effect in terms of that person's rights then to, one, under the law, organize into perhaps a union, perhaps not, ask for better wages and benefits, or if that person is not adequately given what they need in order to protect themselves in a job, such as a construction worker, for example, because the safety gear isn't up to date, a clear violation of both federal and state law, and the employee happens to say to the employer, hey, listen, you know, I think that I need an extra belt or whatever because, you know, or protection because I'm working with chemicals. That employer can just simply say, you know what, you can go find another job, and if you complain any further, you know what, immigration enforcement's just down the street. So you see how this inability for a person to work without status creates a system in which we see much more worker exploitation in non-payment of wages issues, in safety and health violations, then we really, I think that makes most of us really comfortable, right? So we deal with this situation all the time. And I'm just going to mention one case, which is Hoffman Plastics, which is a labor case that was decided back in 2001, I believe, 2001. Which actually, you'll be happy to know, considering your dean, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights determined that countries violate international law when their labor laws discriminate against undocumented workers. And what Hoffman Plastics said, for those of you that are not aware of this case, is that a person who is fired illegally for organizing in the workplace is not subject to the same rights as a legal documented person in terms of then receiving the back pay that would be due to them because of the illegal firing. So I organize, I bring my folks together, I say we need better conditions in the workplace, we can't handle this anymore. I get fired for organizing, which is illegal, and say that because the court finds that firing was illegal, but and so if I had been documented, I would be allowed my 3 months of back pay, right? Because that's what I get because of my the illegal firing. But because I'm undocumented, I don't get that back pay. And guess what? I don't get my job back either. So how is that going to play out for people who are undocumented and then want better working conditions? Clearly, they have no incentives, right? So Huffman plastics is a really big problem, and there's actually legislation in Congress right now trying to, you know, bring that, you know, do away with that decision, court decision. But I am going to pass around just this this brief description by the National Employment Law Center for you all to sort of read through what happens when, you know, what happens in terms of the International Court of Human Rights. And then just something that I briefly want to mention because I don't want to ramble, but something that, to bring things home for you a little bit about currently what's going on. We have a situation right now in which the country has gone through one of the biggest disasters probably ever to hit the United States, right, with Hurricane Katrina and the devastation of New Orleans. Well, the Bush administration says, okay, in the reconstruction efforts, what we're going to do is we're going to do away with the Davis-Bacon Act. No Davis-Bacon requirements. Davis-Bacon basically says, if you are working on a federal project, what you have to do is you have to pay prevailing wage. And you have certain requirements to document who is working, how much they're being paid, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to set on fire any requirements for the Davis-Bacon Act. You as a company can go in there, do whatever you want, pay whatever you want, right? Personally, a slap in the face of all of those poor people that we saw running away from the devastation in their country, in their community, right? Because Davis-Bacon was one of those labor laws that labor unions fought so hard for because it protects workers and it protects the person's ability to make the prevailing wage in that industry. We have no Davis-Bacon. Now then, furthermore, the Bush administration says, oh, and by the way, you don't have to, you know, if you're a company and you're hiring a worker, you're not required to check documents. Because presumably, many people who will be looking for work lost all of those documents in the floods. So you have all of these out-of-state companies, but all of these big-wig companies coming in, hiring, bringing busloads and busloads of undocumented workers to work in New Orleans, to reconstruct New Orleans, doing very, very difficult work. Guess what? Many busloads of people coming back to their home states saying that they haven't been paid for weeks' worth of work. Many instances in which we're finding people saying, I was working with chemicals, no protective gear. Very similar to what happened after September 11th and that cleanup in New York City with all of the asbestos flying around, and you had one set of workers who were not the day laborers with the protective gear, and then you had another set of workers who were Latino mostly with no protective gear. Same thing happening in New Orleans. So I'm going to pass around a press release issued by National Council of La Raza, National Urban League, the NAACP, the Asian American Justice Center, and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, because I want you to understand exactly what the implications are for undocumented workers in the United States currently, how much they're giving to this country, and how little they're getting back. And the utter lack of recognition for their work, I'm not saying that the United States government should have waived a company's requirement to ask for documents and be able to hire undocumented workers. I am certainly not advocating for that. But come on. Wake up. You cannot allow a documented worker to work, clean up debris, work with chemicals, go unpaid, and at the same time not allow that person to even have a single document that allows that person to work in the United States legally, and therefore be let that person be exploited in the way that they're being exploited. So we need comprehensive immigration reform now. We have a very good bill introduced by Senator Kennedy and McCain called the Secure America Act of 2005. Senator Kennedy, McCain, Colby, Flake, Gutierrez, bipartisan, an excellent piece of legislation. It combines perfect the ability for a person to become legalized if they're not legalized in this country, allows for an increase of visas for people to come into the United States in an orderly, safe way so that we know who's coming in, we know who's in the United States, and there is real efforts for enforcement. But first we have to fix our immigration laws. So this all ties in because once people have the legal possibility of working in the United States, we will take care of our illegal, undocumented worker issue. We will allow a safe, orderly way for people who want to come in the future. And it will decrease the amount of the amount of exploitation and vulnerability of the immigrant workers that help us every day, all of us, so much. In our everyday lives, agriculture, construction, services, and almost every single possible industry. So I'm going to hand this stuff out. I guess I'm done. Thank you, and then we can ask questions later. I guess.
Thank you. I'm if you don't mind, I'll stand. This chair is a bit uncomfortable. I'm Roberto Laracuente. I practice law in New York City. I'm a litigator. I'm with a firm called Weiss & Luxembourg. I'm all counsel to the firm. Some of you may have heard of that firm. I have, since law school, since 79, done nothing but represent injured workers and people who get injured. We get involved in representing people who are exposed to asbestos, exposed to all kinds of toxic torts, mass torts. We operate all over the country. One thing that I've always followed, I mean, you wonder why I'm in this type of format, the immigration format. When I first saw it in the email, I felt that that this is really where the action is at. Number one is, you know, all of you are going to be lawyers, so you may be second, third year, or I don't know whether or not the university has an evening student program, but all of you are going to be lawyers. The one thing they cannot stop us from doing is to get that ticket. Whether or not you're in government service, whether or not you're in private practice, or whether or not you choose to teach law, you get that ticket, you get that license. And then once you get that license, you can be fully creative as to what you do with it. One thing that I never permit even a judge or an adversary or anybody to use the word is an illegal immigrant. I'm very happy that counsel here has understands that you never, never, never permit you, whether it's a professor, whether it's a friend, whether it's a mother or father, you never permit anybody to use the word illegal immigrant in your presence. Number one is that somebody has to be adjudicated illegal before they can be so. They may be undocumented, but they're certainly not illegal. But I read Hoffman when it first came out of the U.S. Supreme Court, and the hair really turned it back in my neck. Because it says a lot more than it just that Hoffman comes out of the NLRB. It has to do with a fair labor practices adjudication by the NLRB. It has to do with the enforcement provisions. But it basically says that the laws, the NLRB regulations and the worker laws do not apply to people who are quote-unquote working under a fraud. And they actually use that word fraud. Now, as a personal injury practitioner, and I represent people who fall off scaffolds, people who are found dead in tanks, or people who have been exposed to asbestos all the time, it goes directly to the issue of lost wages. Now, the question is, If somebody is working here, whether with false documentation, a lot of times with a wink, wink from the employer, some person may be making in some of the trades up to $15, $17 an hour. Some of them can be union members and so forth. And then the defense will just come up and say, smirking, they're not entitled to work here. So therefore, what are you doing here? What are you asking for lost wages? And if you have a 25-year-old man who's falling off a scaffold and he's quadriplegic, paralyzed from the neck down, or paraplegic, or worse, he's even dead. What do you do under those circumstances when your large element of your damages is lost earnings? And as a matter of fact, I had a deposition of exactly that situation where a person is quadriplegic, and at the deposition, the defense lawyer was very, very happy in that he was able to establish that my worker had come into the United States. He was Honduras from Mexico, in the rear end of a car. And then they said, oh, that was very happy. But then he said, you know, I'm the only one who walked out of that trunk because there were four people dead inside. And so very quickly, the lawyer backed off from it. Now, we were able to settle that case probably for about $10 million, notwithstanding the fact that he was an undocumented alien, notwithstanding the fact that we would have a tough in a jury selection process, because what happens is that they use the immigration process, the fraud committed, to collaterally impeach your witness. And then while you have to be very careful when you select the jury in terms of what predisposition the jury has and the judge may have, and you have to be very careful in terms of whether or not they're allowed to, permit your worker to have the full canopy of rights. And so we were able to basically stare them down, notwithstanding the fact. Because what Hoffman does is that it prevents witnesses from coming up. What happens is that if somebody falls from a scaffold or see somebody in an unsafe labor practice happening, what happens is that the witness himself or herself is an undocumented alien. And that witness will know if that person comes up, then that person is going to be subject to the enforcement provisions of the immigration process. And a lot of them just don't choose not to get involved. A lot of women get raped. They don't choose to go to hospitals. They don't choose to get involved with the police. Why? Because if they do, they'll come up on the radar screen. Now, that doesn't mean that person who was assaulted does not have rights vis-a-vis a security issue involving the premises, a lot of times in pump premises. I happen to live in New York City. I practice in New York City. In 9/11, there was a restaurant on top called Windows on the World. Now, there are over 1,000 people that are not accounted for. I'll bet you anything that a vast majority of these people are undocumented aliens whose people couldn't even claim their remains. They're sitting at a landfill in Staten Island right now as we speak. Because if they claim them, they'll come up on the radar screen and they'll find themselves in a very, very severe problem being deported. So from what I do, as representing injured workers in personal injury cases who are seriously injured, I don't represent people with whiplash, I represent deaths, fractures, and so forth. The immigration situation in this country, it is, as we speak, on a day-to-day basis, the long-term goals of immigration reform, the political reform, that may or may not happen under the current political climate. But we, as lawyers, can push the envelope. We can say, okay, so you cannot prove a lost earnings issue, but there's a pain and suffering issue, there's a loss of consortium issue. There are many, many, many more elements that we often have to advocate with the parents. We have to. I have a client, a woman, whose husband died in a construction accident. The employer went up to the woman and says, listen, you got four kids, all of them were born in this country, but you came here from Honduras, you're undocumented alien, blah, blah, blah. And so forth. Here's $5,000, five tickets to go back to your country, get the F out of here. The woman took the money and then came over to us. We represented, she took the cash and the tickets, representing her. We settled the case for over $4 million, and she's very happily went back to Honduras, where she lives very well right now. Okay? Now, this is all that happened now under this case happened to be pre-Hoffman. But it really wouldn't make a difference in any of those. I represent Polish people from, let's face it, why did we come to this country? I came from here from Puerto Rico in 1957 because we couldn't eat there. And then I could, you know, here, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I basically went to law school at night and so forth, and, but I became a lawyer. Once having become a lawyer, you have that ticket. And one of the reasons why I agreed to participate in this process here is because it exposes me and counsels here to put up people saying, listen, there are lawyers who have made it. But once you have that ticket, the whole world is your client, including the people with the immigration issue. There are always going to be an issue, and you as a lawyer are going to be charged with how to handle that particular issue in the immediate situation that you have now. The worker that was injured, the woman who was in a hospital, and the doctor says, hey, listen, you know, so you can't do anything about it, so therefore I'll permit you to I'll try a cesarean on you. Hey, so what if I've never done it before or anything like this? Or perhaps, yeah, you shouldn't have a cesarean, but you're not going to do anything about it anyway. And the fact is, these people have to be told they do have rights. The ones who were exposed to these chemicals on the fields, we represent probably about 10,000 of those workers against the major manufacturers of the pesticides and so forth. We represent the people in Beaupark. And I'm waiting to, and as we see now in Louisiana, I mean, doesn't anybody think that there was a severe negligence in permitting those levees to be constructed in the way that they were so that they overflowed? I mean, the defendants were arguing an act of God and so forth like that. But there's tons of areas in there. Now, we, as lawyers, we provide access to our community because they can't do it by themselves, but we can do it. We have to do it. And then the thing that's great about it is that once they have access, rule number one is we create an immediate remedy as well as being able to feed ourselves and feed our family and feed our community. And so the one thing that I will always emphasize is that being in law school is very difficult and time consuming and so forth. But get that ticket. Once you get that ticket, you create, open your own doors, move forward, deal with the immigration issue, because that is the hotbed issue as we speak right now. Immigration and access to lawyers. La Raza has been a long, long, long time involving out of the Southwest. In New York City, we have the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund. We have the Urban League. But the people who are really making the big impact now are the people going, the lawyers going into the communities and representing the clients against the slum lord, representing the family whose child has eaten lead poisoned paint on the walls and so forth. And so the political system will come at us with a Hoffman and will deny access to the lawyers basically by trying to do away with the contingency retainer and then also with the loser wins, and basically has to pay under certain circumstances. So the idea being is that, don't be discouraged by anything that you hear here under any circumstances. Just remember that once you become a lawyer, just get into the communities, do what you have to do, get involved in the judicial screening process, encourage people to get involved in it, and then deal with the issues as you have them. Be aware of the long-term goals, but you have a client sitting in front of you that you have to forward, you have to represent, and you have to represent the best that you possibly can. But I'm sure we'll be around here to answer questions a bit later on.
Thanks very much. I'm going to try to use this thing.
Can everyone hear me? My name is Alex McLean. I'm here from the Department of Justice, Office of Special Counsel on Immigration-Related Unfair Employment Practices. I'm covering for the special counsel, Will Sanchez, who wasn't able to make it here today. But if you do get a chance to see him speak, he's really an expert in the field of immigration and practiced down in South Florida for a long time and just someone who really knows the issue. So I would definitely try to see him if you have that chance. I'm going to definitely agree with what Roberta was talking about as far as when you get out of law school, there's a lot of different paths you can take, and especially being Latino and Hispanic law students, you're going to have a lot of opportunities. By, I think, 2050, there's going to be 100 million Hispanics in the United States, people of Hispanic descent. So you really have a great opportunity, and if you're interested in immigration, income tax, whatever, those are the fields you should, you know, try to make your way in, because you definitely have a good advantage over a lot of other people. I'm going to talk briefly about our office and what we do. As Flavia talked a little bit about, in 1986, IRCA came in, which was the Immigration Reform and Control Act. What IRCA did was it established employer sanctions for knowingly hiring undocumented workers, established the I-9 process, which everybody, I'm sure, is familiar with, and then created our office, the Office of Special Counsel, which enforces the anti-discrimination provisions of the Act. It's 8 U.S.C. 1324B, if you want to do a little homework on it. A GAO report came out in 1990 talking about what kind of discrimination was happening after IRCA came out. Basically, what they found was citizens and legal workers, people who appeared foreign, people with accents, were being discriminated against by employers. Now, how much of discrimination was found? About 1/5 of all employers were discriminating against employees in this manner, which it basically was about 1 million employers throughout the United States, affecting about 7 million employees. The four main discrimination charges that we handle at the Office of Special Counsel is citizenship status discrimination, national origin discrimination, document abuse, and retaliation and intimidation discrimination. I'll go over briefly, I know you guys probably want to get to lunch pretty soon, what are these types of discrimination? Citizenship status and immigration status discrimination is discrimination with respect to hiring, firing, and recruitment or referral for a fee. What kind of employers are subject to this charge? It's any employer with 3 or more employees. Protected classes under this statute are U.S. citizens, U.S. nationals, asylees, refugees, temporary residents, and legal permanent residents. Some examples of citizenship or immigration status discrimination that our office covers would be citizen-only hiring practices, green card-only hiring practices, preferring undocumented workers over workers with papers, and different hiring procedures for U.S. citizens as opposed to immigrants. The second discrimination that our office handles is national origin discrimination. And what national origin discrimination is discrimination that by an employer against the protected class that I mentioned earlier, and that would be discrimination linked to a person's place of birth, their country of origin, their ancestry, native language, or accent. In this one category, we only cover employers who have more than 3 but less than 15 employees, so between 4 and 14 employees. Basically, what we are is a mini EEOC. If there's this type of discrimination and it's an employer who has more than 15 employees, then the EEOC would handle that type of case. The third type of discrimination that I mentioned was document abuse, and by far that's the most common charge that our office handles. Same protected class, U.S. citizens, U.S. nationals, and legal workers. What are some examples of document abuse? It would be an employer who requires those people who appear foreign to show more documents or different documents than they would for someone who looked white. Another example of document abuse would be to go over an immigrant's valid documents with greater scrutiny than they would someone else who didn't appear to be an immigrant. And then the final discrimination that our office handles is intimidation or retaliation. Basically, that states persons or entities may not intimidate, threaten, coerce, or retaliate against anyone who's basically filing a charge with our office or who may be a witness in a case that's going to be a charge in our office. Like the two speakers, panelists have spoken, like immigration is definitely a hot issue right now in Washington, and I'm sure a lot of you have been following it in the news. There's the Corn and Kyle bill and the McCain-Kennedy bill, which you mentioned. The White House came out this week kind of with a very broad overview of some of the issues that they want to have addressed in the two bills if they come to be synthesized at some point. Our office, how do charges become charges? Anyone who's an injured party or nonprofit organization, advocates can file a charge with our office. Our office also handles independent investigations. If we get a tip from someone out in the community about an employer who practices these unfair discrimination practices, the charge must be filed within 180 days of when the discrimination takes place, and our office usually has to get the investigation and everything done within 7 months. Remedies for these type of cases or charges are hiring and or rehiring of the employee, trying to get back pay for time lost, cease and desist order, civil penalties for the employers, and training and monitoring. So basically that's a brief overview of our office. We do the enforcement, which is under 1324B. We also do education through our grantees and outreaches where we try to get out to the public and the community, because a lot of people who even practice in the immigration field don't know anything about our office, have never heard of it. We're really a small office. Our office has 40 employees, about 30 attorneys. We're based out of D.C. Our jurisdiction is over the whole United States. In the statute, it says we can have pilot offices, but that hasn't happened yet. So a lot of people don't know about us. Even within Civil Rights Division of Justice, people don't know exactly what we do. So this is part of like what we're trying to get done, let people know through our grantees, through different outreaches throughout the whole United States. And then we have a partnership with EEOC where we coordinate different cases. If it's not something that we can handle, we'll send it on to them. If they have something which is with more in tune to our statute, one of the four discriminations, they'll send it to us. And then we do something that's kind of unique. I've never heard of it. We operate a toll-free 800 hotline for employers and employees. So basically, and it's actually answered by a real person, a staff attorney at our office. What happens is someone may call from Houston or wherever, and they may have TPS status, and their employer has no idea what TPS is. It might be a small employer. They'll talk to our attorney. Their attorneys, we have attorneys who speak, you know, the five main languages, but if it's the language we don't have someone who can speak it, we'll get someone in there to translate. And they'll say, I have TPS status, my employer's not recognizing it, he's going to fire me tomorrow, or my work authorization papers are up, my TPS has been extended, he doesn't know anything about it. We'll get on the phone with the employer, make sure their documents are okay, and let them know, check the Federal Register or USCIS, and this person should be working. So a lot of our cases, what happens there is what we call intervention. They don't ever get to a formal charge or to court, because no one really wants to go to court. We'd rather get it resolved and get the people back in working as soon as possible. So that's basically the overview of my office. I know it's 12:30. I don't know if we want to handle questions or.
We started late, so maybe.
I have two questions, actually. First, for Mr. McClain. seems like a lot of what you've been talking about has been workers who've been exploited by businesses that are at least facially part of the graphic economy, where at least they care about the formalities of looking for I-9s and things like that. So I was wondering what percentage of work done by undocumented workers in the above ground economy versus, say, underground economy where, it's strictly cash and they don't even care about I-9 or anything like that.
On the first part of it, on our website, I'll read right from it, just because I've only been at Justice a few months. We have a partnership with EOC, and we participate in different workshops throughout the country, part of our outreach. And basically, we're trying to increase understanding of employer sanctions and protections against discrimination. In an effort to increase the accessibility to its services and resources, we've signed and reinvigorated memorandum of understanding with different state and local human rights agencies where individuals can obtain information about OSC and EEOC. But basically, it's kind of a coordination. If they have a case, because some people might file in our office and it may not fall under one of the four abuses that we handle, discrimination charges. If it's more closely to something EEOC handles, we'll send it on to them, and likewise they'll do the same for us. As far as and under our statute for national origin discrimination, we only handle between 4 and 14 employees. So if it's more than that, then we'd automatically send it to them. So that, and how I got there, basically I was interested. I worked on the campaign for President Bush last year and moved on to the inaugural committee, and they asked me if I wanted to work in the administration. They asked me some of the issues that I was interested in. Immigration was one of them. I also speak Spanish. My mom's from Bogota, and did a couple of interviews, and that's how I wound up at Justice. So. Okay. And as far as the second part?
I don't have any numbers for you. A good place that you might want to check out is there are a few organizations that actually work on getting the Pew Hispanic Center is probably a good place to check out. The problem with getting exact numbers on undocumented workforce or generally on the underground economy is that it's exactly that. So you might have a company that is actually hiring both documented immigrants and paying taxes on those immigrants and on those people, but then you might also have that same company also hiring those people who are undocumented and paying them cash, and so you might have the same company doing both, and so it's almost like having a mixed status family. Like, you don't really know who's who. So, you might have problems finding that exact number. But I don't know if you know of. The Urban Institute is another great place that you might want to check out. Then they have great studies, so they might have some information on that.
Let me give you an example of a case I recently handled. There was a worker involving these called drop ceilings that they're suspended by wires. And then there was a particular premises was being demolished. And then these wires were sticking up out of the wall. And then the worker was involved in demolishing the place. Well, what happened is that the New York State regulations and OSHA regulations require a certain amount of eye protection, goggles, and so forth. And then this person happened to be Puerto Rican, had no problem with immigration, and he was told to clean up the area, and as a result of it, one of those wires went into his eye and enucleated his eye. That meant that the whole eye was taken out, and he's got a little porcelain bowl in there now. We were doing depositions, and I was doing depositions, and then the employer was claiming that all proper safeguards and all proper equipment and so forth was provided. So then we, as lawyers, through the discovery process, we got their inventory of all the equipment they received, all the equipment they maintained, all the, it was a voluminous record, which we had to go through page by page. And I was able to account that they had eye protection for the number of people whom they told the owner were going to be employed at the premises, which was maybe 15. There was actually about 100 workers on the job site. And so that meant that you had 15, of those 15 gargles, five were defective, and then and maybe one or two people were actually using them. And then they have somebody outside, and when the building inspector comes by, then everybody goes into hiding. Now, so in that situation, you had about, 80 people, that the way that they got these girls on the corner, I don't know how many of you speak Spanish, but they would get one of our own, go to the corner and say, usted quiere trabajar hoy, and then the person would come up, and to go upstairs and blah, 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 and then they pay him in cash. They pay him 50, 100 bucks, in cash. And then we were methodically, able to establish that proper eye protection wasn't given, but the side effect of that was that we were able to see that all of the people that were not accounted for in the official inventory.
We've been in this issue at nauseam, and
and we don't know what else to do. The Real ID Act just got signed into law last session. It's like a cloud because I would rather just forget that it ever existed. And no one heard about it. It's probably going to be more detrimental to the immigrant community than anything that has passed since 1996, and no one even paid attention. And the reason is because this Congress slipped it into the Iraqi supplemental, must-pass legislation to appropriate money to our troops and to the tsunami victims. The Real ID Act basically is going to reshape and reshuffle the way that every single person in the United States who drives a vehicle and has a license gets that license, obtains that license, and then that how that identification can be used to get into certain federal buildings, for example. It's an issue that we've touched for a number of years. It's an issue that should be dealt with by the state motor vehicle associations. The state legislatures need to have the right, actually, federally, to mandate certain requirements for their own driver's licenses. And it's a problem for our community, but it's not just a problem for our community. It's a problem for every single person who drives, because you have uninsured, unlicensed people who are driving vehicles right now because they're not allowed to get driver's licenses based on their documented status. We're turning the driver's license into a national identification card. A driver's license should just say that you are who you say you are, that you live where it says you live, and that you can drive. Why is it that that it's turned into this national identification card for purposes of identifying yourself? You know, 9/11 and terrorism have nothing to do with a driver's license. If you want to assure that a person doesn't get on an airplane with a bomb, then check them out before they get on the airplane. Don't turn the driver's license into a national ID, which is exactly what's happened. The Real ID Act and Mr. Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, I get chills every time I got like the shakes. Check out the information that we have on NCLR and Real ID, what we've been doing on driver's licenses in the states and on the federal level. I completely agree with you 100%.
I did see like a couple months ago the National Governors Conference where they came out and basically said this is, I don't know if it's a federalism problem, but they were afraid and basically said we can't really comply with this. This is going to be overburdensome to us. And then another problem for on the Real ID Act is because each state has different requirements and different type of people who can get licenses. I know for a fact in Tennessee they issue licenses for undocumented
driving certificates
right. So if a lot of people, what they're doing is if they're undocumented and they may live in a state around Tennessee because it's easier to get a driver's license there, they'll hop over there and try to do, because Tennessee is looking at it from the insurance angle.
Right.
You know, if I'm an undocumented worker, day laborer, and I need to get to my job or do whatever, I need to drive. I need to pay, I need to pay food for rent. I need to feed my kids. So I'm going to get in a car whether you give me a license or not. So, I mean, that's an issue you need to watch.
35% difference in the rate of uninsured drivers once Utah passed their driver's license bill that allowed undocumented people to get licenses. So you had a 35% increase in the people of insured drivers in Utah once that law was passed. Now forget it. We're going to have federal standards for all driver's licenses for all states without a single penny going to any state to help them in the implementation of this.
It's supposed to take effect 2008?
3 years. It's a nightmare. I don't know what Sensenbrenner was on. But no one heard about it. No one knew about it.
Well, just that's the thing. It's all a process, though. Like, people have to drive. You know, in my area, like, for example, these construction workers all go on the van. They all have to have a driver's license. They have to have insurance. They will get in an accident, unfortunately. in most states, I know New York State has it, what's called an MVIC, Motor Vehicle Accident Identification Card, which means that if a person is unlicensed, uninsured, number one, he or she risks going to jail, but number two, the medical expenses and the pain and suffering and so forth, the ward, are all paid out by all the other insurance companies, and who are just backed up by the public revenue funds. So I think what's ultimately going to happen is that people will drive. People will have to drive. People will get in accidents. And then people will flee the accidents and so that they don't get in touch with these circumstances. Right. But those of us who are involved as victims of accidents, we usually have our own insurance companies. We will usually file for what we call first-party benefits against the insurance company. Ultimately, we will be compensated for those circumstances, but ultimately, it's going to flow up this problem of uncompensated mandate or so forth like that. It's only a matter of time before that happens, and believe me, that the repercussions of that are going to be felt a lot faster than trying the current political climate in which we are currently are now, because these people are going to see them, these insurance companies, I'm going to see them losing money hands over fist over this particular issue, because they usually cannot write, just they can't pick and choose what they're going to write in a particular state. The jurisdiction usually makes them write all kinds of different insurances other than what they consider themselves profitable. So ultimately, that is going to the current political climate cannot keep on suppressing these particular issues. These particular issues will perk up, but again, as always goes back to my theme, as a lawyer, you have to push these issues from the bottom up. You have to make them go up to the surface, and you have to force the insurance companies to pay. You have to force the states through their uncompensated victims funds and whatever to have to pay for these funds. And believe me, changes will happen as a result of that.
I don't have my card. I can tell you my email. It's F as in Frank, Jimenez, J-I-M-E-N-E-Z, at nclr.org.
I'm on the internet, I'm sure everybody here is. My name is Roberto Lara Quente. I practice with White and Luxembourg. You know, we have a website. There's even a picture of me in there, and a little bio and stuff like that. And I have a proprietary email, which is rl.laraquente.com. There's always the email that's in the internet. You can follow. I'm also listed in Edison, New Jersey. You can always call me at any time.
Home and home. NCLR's website has a lot of great information, too, if you guys want to go on there. It's just nclr.org.
I've got some cards, I don't know if I can have enough for everybody, but my email is alex.maclean@usdoj.gov.
Thanks, everyone.